So here we are, almost at the tail end of our time together. I was really appreciating the group meetings today and hearing how the practice was developing for people. And many people agreed that it would be good to have another day. And I was very delighted when somebody who had not been on retreat before, who didn't know what she was coming to, wanted more days. And so, you know, it is that usually day three is when things start really getting going, you know. And we usually teach a 7-day, our average is a 7-day retreat at Spirit Rock and at the East Coast Center and Insight Meditation Society. So that's it's a good amount of time, as you can see now, because, you know, by day three, you're starting to get not the hindrances, actually it's the hindrances, the tiredness and the restlessness, some of the doubt and some of that movement of the mind of wanting and not wanting. It starts to calm down a little bit more, and there's more access to the awareness itself, and it's easier. Things become a little bit easier. So by the third day, you know, as things calm down, having a few more days to just be in this space is a really good thing. And yet this is what we've got, and it's been really rich. It's a really been rich for people, and I've just felt so pleased, so delighted. I don't think we could have set up something better than this. This is just, it's just the best it could have been. I'm just, we're very lucky, huh? Very lucky to make this into a traditional Buddhist Vipassana meditation retreat. And this is really, you've got a very good taste now, a very good experience of this. So I'm really, really pleased, really happy with how things have gone. And what we, one way that I see what's happening is there is this shift, shift of our vision of how we're seeing, how we're viewing. Like Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, what is life but the angle of vision? What is life but the angle of vision? And so through the practice and through the cultivation, the deepening into awareness, we're actually, in a way, changing our vision, changing our view, the way that we see things. And one way of talking about that is we're seeing through the lens of awareness. We start to see through the lens of awareness, which is Dharma mind. That's where the Dharma, this Dharma, the way things are, the nature, the law of things, it opens up and our mind becomes a Dharma mind, seeing through the lens of awareness rather than through the lens of the ego self or the sense of me, or we might call that the ordinary mind, the ordinary conventional mind that sees things from the perspective of a me that's here and everything else is out there. This sense of the separation. Mm-hmm. And without the lens of awareness, without the eyes of awareness that can see something bigger, more of the totality, we just see life becomes this very dualistic, this very this and that, me and you. Mm-hmm. Everything's just this self and other. And it can feel very limited in that way. And so we're putting on these new eyes, we might say Dharma eyes, Dharma vision, you know, the vision of awareness. And everything begins to change. I mean, you can see already just in a couple of days, you know, there's the shift that starts to happen when you see things with different eyes, where things just start to become a little more alive, and you feel a bit more connected to people or the place or the nature, to yourself, to your own experience. This quality of being present, or I call it presence, a quality of presence starts to emerge, where I feel here, I'm here. There's a sense of this, more of a connectedness with experience and the unfolding moment to moment to moment. Dharma mind is a mind that sees the Dharma, or a mind that knows the Dharma. And the Dharma is this revelation, the revelation of the way things really are, beyond the sense of me, me and other, self and other. A more total or holistic, whole view of how things operate, how things are, the law or the nature of things. In the Pali language, it would be called satipanya. Sati is the mindfulness, panya is wisdom. Mindfulness and wisdom. The wisdom comes through the awareness or the mindfulness. Satipanya. And this is really what we're cultivating. This is what we're doing. We're cultivating this awareness and this wisdom. The wisdom comes through the opening of the clear seeing, seeing more clearly. And as we've talked about, there is a brightening, a lighting up, waking up. Many people have said, I feel more awake, I'm waking up while I'm here. You know? And having some contrast to how experience is like before the retreat, with being in more of the busyness and the momentum of things, and then coming here after some days and having a little more quiet and peace, the mind settles, and then being able to look back at the mind from before and see it is much busier, more restless, more distracted. Yeah. So when we're more in what's called the ordinary mind, conventional mind, the day-to-day mind, the mind that gets caught up in the day-to-day activities and responsibilities and commitments, sometimes we lose the bigger view. We lose that the bigger view of awareness, the awareness eyes, the Dharma eyes. So we've been looking at this ordinary mind, because we want to know the difference between this just the usual, ordinary, conventional mind and the Dharma mind, or the mind that can see, the awareness mind, that the wisdom mind that can see more clearly. And we've talked about how the ordinary mind is often ruled by these forces of greed and hatred and confusion, delusion. And greed, we use the word greed, it's often sometimes lust, you know, the lusting after, or the wanting mind, that wanting, that energy that's going out to things, and the mind of hate or anger or aversion that pushes away, and then the mind that is just confused and doesn't really know much of what's going on at all and isn't so aware. And that how this ordinary mind is often ruled by these forces, and we can see how this can actually cause a lot of problems, not only for ourselves but in the world. And our world is the problems in the world are all because of these strong forces of the mind of greed, hatred, and confusion. There's this a quote from Shantideva, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. This Bodhisattva, again, is a person who is committed to ending suffering for all beings. All their activities, all their actions goes towards the ending of suffering and the act of compassion. So this is from the guide that Shanti Deva, it's a very famous guide. And there's this nice piece here where it says, those who wish to guard their practice should very attentively guard their minds. For those who do not guard their minds will be unable to guard their practice. In this world, unsubdued and crazed elephants are incapable of causing such harms as the miseries of the deepest hell, which can be caused by the unleashed elephant of my mind. Saying crazed elephants can't even cause the same kind of misery as the unleashed elephants of my own mind. But it says, if those elephants of my mind are firmly bound on all sides by the rope of mindfulness, all fears will cease to exist and all virtues will come into my hand. So the elephant of my mind, in this teaching, the elephant of my mind, that crazed mind, needs to be firmly bound on all sides by the rope of mindfulness. Right? And mindfulness is the guard, the guardian. Mindfulness is the guardian of the mind. One of my teachers, Sokni Rinpoche, a Tibetan teacher, used an example. He said, mindfulness is like the doorman at the hotel. And you know, at a hotel, there's a man who's sort of good hotels, nice hotel, who will open the door for you when you come. But the hotel doorman won't open the door for anybody. He will only open the door for guests that will take care of the hotel. But anybody who looks like they might not be a good guest will not be invited into the hotel. The door will be closed. No, sorry, you can't come in. And so the mindfulness is like the hotel doorman. It stands by, and it notices what's coming by. And is it okay to open the door? Is it okay to let that guest in? And it doesn't let all the guests in. It shuts them out. And this is what's meant by the rope of mindfulness. You know, you stand guard, guarding the practice, guarding the mind, that it's okay to let the guests in who are kind and caring and respectful and dressed well, you know, who don't look like they're going to cause mischief. But if they're not, they don't get to come in. And this is a kind of the wisdom of the doorman who can tell when to open the door and when not to open the door. The problem for us is that we just keep the door open and we're not really paying attention sometimes what's coming in. So everything comes in and then we wonder why this room is so filled with unruly things. No? I'm remembering my teacher in India, Papaji, would talk about it this way. He said, when you leave your doors and your windows open, you're inviting the thieves to come in. And the thieves will come in and steal all your jewels, all your money, all your jewels. He said, don't leave all your windows and your doors open. Shut them. But somehow we have this idea that, oh, you know, we're just supposed to just let everything, you know, come in and, you know, this kind of open. But there's no wisdom. There's not enough. It's maybe there's a, you know, an open, kind, generous attitude, but there's not enough wisdom. So in the teachings, it's not just mindfulness, it's called wise mindfulness. Sammasati. Sammasati. Samma means wise or right. You know, the correct mindfulness. That means there's wisdom that's actually attending and being able to tell when to allow and when to say no. No, it's not okay. It's like a firm, like a good parent. Like a good parent. You know, a parent doesn't just let the child just run around and do anything that it wants to do. The child needs discipline. The child needs to be told, no, that's not okay. That's how we learn. So it's the same, we have to do the same with our mind. You're going to say no. Because our mind, like I was saying yesterday, our mind is like an adolescent mind. It's just running around, wants to do whatever it wants. It doesn't really have good rules. Actually, they're finding out that the adolescent mind isn't actually very well developed. It's just not a developed brain. So there isn't any, sometimes there isn't really even a, there's not enough development in the brain itself to be able to make good choices, to be able to make wise choices. So they still need the discipline. They need a good parent. So mindfulness, wise mindfulness, is like the good parent. So this is where the deeper understanding of what this practice is about. When we know we've been talking about this, like knowing what to follow and what not to follow. What's helpful, what's not helpful. What's useful, what's not useful. These are all the ways we talk about it. When the mind is just doing its thing, we know how to say, no, I don't want that in. I'm not going to let that in. It's enough. Some people were talking about just that, how the same, you know, the repetition of the same thoughts again and again and again. So the stories, the same stories and same stories. And when we move the attention, when we shift the attention to the breath or the body, it's a way of saying, no, I'm turning away. I'm turning away from that. I don't want to hear it anymore. So we have some way to turn the attention, to turn away. It's a way of shutting the door, of shutting the window. Right? So, but we have to know how to make that choice. It's enough. No. But we not only do this with our own mind, we have to do this with people. Sometimes other people's other minds, not just our minds, other people's minds are going on and on and on and on, saying, enough. Enough. No. I don't want to hear anymore. No. But we do this out of wisdom, and it's a kind of compassion. It's a loving response. It might be strong, but it's a loving response, because sometimes we need to set these boundaries. We need to set a limit. You can't just let things just go all over when the mind is like this elephant mind. It's just unruly. Unruly. If there's not enough wisdom in the mind that needs some. It needs some boundaries, some direction, some firmness. It says no. So it's important to know too that this is also part of what we're working with when we are talking about this, the awareness, the mind, the Dharma mind, the mind of awareness. So the Dharma mind, the aware mind, can see, can know this ordinary mind, this conventional mind, the thoughts, the images, the ideas, the beliefs, and from the wisdom of the Dhamma mind, we can say no, or yes, no, yes. Mm-hmm. So not only are we getting to know the ordinary mind, but we also want to know this Dhamma mind. Like, what is this? What is this Dharma mind? What is this mind that is free? The mind that is free of these forces of greed and hatred and delusion, a mind that can see clearly the way things really are. In the Buddha's teachings, one of the core teachings, the primary teachings in the Buddhist path, is to understand that what we see with the Dharma mind is what's called the three characteristics of existence, the three signs of existence, which are impermanence, the suffering element, and what's called the impersonal or the non-self, and the non-self element. So the impermanence, the fact that all of existence is impermanent, it comes and it goes, it's not permanent, it's not solid, it's not fixed. We can see this directly with our Dharma mind, with our awareness. We start to see that dukkha or that suffering element, that when we hold on, it's painful. When we go into the contraction and the tightness, it has a painful element. It has an unpleasant element. And we start to see that with the Dharma mind. We start to understand the way that suffering arises and how it ends. How it arises and how it ends. And the third one is around what's called the impersonal, that things are not so personal, but yet we take things so personally, like we have this feeling that I am in the center. It's all about me, right? This is the when there's not clear seeing, there's this belief that I am here and everything is really about me. I think that one reason that we get so caught up in our thinking is because in our thoughts, we become the center of attention. Our thoughts are all about me. And there's something we like about that. We like to be in the center and to be getting all this attention. And so we just keep thinking about all these different parts of our life. The past, the present, the future, and it's all about me. And this is where, from when there's not the Dharma understanding, we lose that sense that actually there's more going on than just me. There's a much, much bigger world. And not only that, but I am part of it. I am intricately connected to all things. I am interconnected, interdependent with all things. There's no separation. There's no gap at all. It's not so personal. All of this is actually much larger, much bigger than me. And one of the things about standing when the sky is clear and it is nighttime, when it's actually dark, which you know very well, but when you stand under the sky and there's not many lights from the city, you just see there's this vast universe. And there's a vast universe of galaxies and stars and galaxies, and galaxies are whole other solar systems and universes, and it's infinite. And yet there's a way that I think it's all about me. I mean, it was a wonderful thing when the astronauts went to the moon and then looked back at the Earth for the first time, when everything dissolved into this beautiful blue ball. Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing to think about sometimes, because we are just a speck of dust, a speck of dust on this blue ball that's floating in this vast space of the universe. But one little ball amongst billions and billions of balls of stars. Yeah. And we can, our minds can't even really comprehend. I mean, we're only just starting to learn about it. And when I read the news and these scientists say, oh, we discovered a new galaxy, you know, of a whole new solar system, you know, where there can be perhaps maybe new life, you know, and it's like a whole new aspect of the universe. It's like I can't even get my mind around it. So yet when we're in our meditation, there's a possibility of as the mind starts to become more quiet and settles down, and the stories of me start to quiet down, then we start to touch something where we can consider, well, then who am I? Who am I without the story? Who am I when I'm not telling myself a story of me? Then who am I? Where do I find myself? Where am I? Am I this body? Am I then just this body? Is that who I am? Well, I don't seem to have a lot of control over this body either. No, things can happen. How can I say that's who I am? That's me. So it's we start to wonder where we can find ourselves if we start to question in this way. And then perhaps things become less personal. Less personal means not just about me. But that's, you know, it's a something that begins to happen in our meditation when we're walking in the nature, or we're in a community like this and we're moving around together, and we become in some ways, as a community, one organism. I wonder if you've had that experience here. I mean, I know some people were talking about how you bump into each other also, but it's, you're not always bumping into each other. You know, you're also moving around very smoothly, you know, making space for each other and pulling out chairs and getting the food. And there's a way you can kind of harmonize in the space together. And you start to move together as one body, almost like one organism. I feel that sometimes, even driving in the car, I'm always amazed that there aren't more accidents. That, you know, somehow it all seems to be running along. People are in their cars and driving, and people are making turns, and it all seems to operate somehow. It all seems to be working efficiently, the systems, and, you know, it's like, how is that? How is it that it's all moving in some kind of intelligent way? So it's so much more mysterious. There's so much more mystery to all of this than how I construct my own idea of who I am and who other people are and what this world is about. So we start to question some of those beliefs and some of those constructions. So these three characteristics, these three signs or marks of existence, that all things are impermanent, coming and going, that nothing is fixed, nothing lasts, that if I try to hold on to that which is changing, I will feel the suffering of that holding on. There's a good word for that, holding on. It's like when we hold on to that which is changing, it's like holding on to a rope when it's being pulled and we get rope burn. We're like trying to keep the rope steady, but it's being pulled and our hands burn. It's just like, that's the dukkha. It's like rope burn. Right? Because things are moving, things are changing, and we're like, hold on, hold on, and then we just feel the burning of it. Mm-hmm. That's the dukkha, because things are changing. And when we hold on, we are taking things so personally. It's about me, because what I want and what I don't want. And so that view starts to open, it starts to let go. And we see things are not so personal. This Ajahn Chah has this lovely teaching. Ajahn Chah was one of the great Thai Buddhist meditation masters in Thailand. He has this teaching about impermanence, which is, in Pali, it's anicca, anicca. And anicca in the Pali, a means not, and nicca means permanent. So anicca, not permanent. Not permanent, right? So he says, so somebody asked him, how can you find right understanding, right? Or view, the right view, right understanding, right view, samaditti. Ajahn Chah, you may have heard this before, Ajahn Chah says, I can answer you simply by using this glass of water that I'm holding. It appears to us as clean and useful, something to drink from and keep for a long time. Right understanding is to see this as a broken glass, as if it is already shattered. Sooner or later, it will be shattered. If you keep this understanding while you're using it, that all it is a combination of elements which come together in this form and then break apart, then no matter what happens to the glass, you will have no problem. So it's a wonderful metaphor, you know, remembering that the glass is already broken. The cup is already broken, right? Because it will be. He says it's just elements that have come together, conditions that have come together and will fall apart, as all things do. Things come together, fall apart, come together, fall apart. And then he talks about this body, right? This body. He says, this body is like the glass. It is also going to break apart and die. You have to understand that. Yet when you do, it doesn't mean you should go ahead and kill yourself. Just as you shouldn't take this glass and go ahead and throw it away and break it. He said, the glass is something to use until it falls apart in its own natural way. In the same way, the body is a vehicle to use until it goes its own way. Right? Your task is to see what the natural way of things is. Everything has its own natural way. Right? This understanding can make you free in all the changing circumstances of the entire world. Can make you free in all of the changing circumstances in the entire world. Because we forget that everything that is born is going to die. Everything in this realm of existence in which we live. This is the law, this is the Dharma, this is the way things are, whether we like it or whether we don't like it. And you can see how unresolved this is for people. People are so afraid of dying, so afraid of death. It's what, I think it is the number one fear, right? The number one, maybe public speaking is the number one.
Same thing.
Chris said it's the same thing. It's death. Yeah, it's like, yeah, we do feel like we're going to die. It takes a long time to get used to it. But it's like, it's so, we haven't resolved it. Come to peace. Come to peace with it. But of course we're going to hold on. Of course we're going to be attached. You know, it's just, it's also the way we are as human beings. But perhaps we can hold on, and then when we come closer to the reality of the loss of that leaving, then we have some way of working with our grief and our sense of loss in a way that is compassionate and kind with ourselves and with others. Because we do lose what we love. We don't get what we want and lose what we love, and it's painful. It's dukkha. Right? So again, it's not wrong. It's not wrong that we feel these attachments and that we hold on and we don't want to let go. It's natural. It's part of our human condition. But we can also learn. We can also learn how to let go a little bit more so that it isn't so painful. It's like we get used to it. You know, like Ajahn Chah, the cup is already broken. Right? It's already broken. This body is in some ways already broken. I mean, it certainly seems like it's breaking down pretty quickly. Certainly at a certain age. It seems to go more quickly. But then we see ways that we are attached. We see ways we're holding on as things change. Right? As things change and as things pass away and as people pass away, we see where we're holding. And when we see where we're holding, it gives us material for our practice. It gives us work. Work to look more clearly, more carefully through the Dharma eyes, through the eyes of awareness, to see what we can understand. Because the Buddha says we can come to the end of this suffering. We can come to the end of this holding. We can come to the end to this attaching. So we can be free. We can be free and allow things to come and allow things to go. And in that, as we release and as we let go, what comes through is the beautiful qualities of the heart. And what I can call the birth of love. It's like the birth of love coming through that space, coming through the space of awareness, when the mind lets go and it's not so tight and contracted, the heart isn't so tight, and you open the opening, and then what comes through is the love, the compassion, the kindness, the care, and we meet life as a person, as a human being, with a compassionate heart, with a loving heart. It's not like we, as we become more free and become more Buddha-like, we start to disappear. Like, it's not like there's nobody there. When we talk about it's not so personal, it doesn't mean that we just start to disappear. We're still here. But the one who is here is a different one. It's a different one. It's one who is now more embodied with the love, with the heart, with the beauty, with the compassion, the truthfulness. It's connected and aligned with the way things are, with the Dharma. Aligned with the Dharma. And there's so many teachings around the opening of the heart and the qualities of the heart that come forth. And they're usually talked about within the context of the four. It's called the four divine abodes, or the four divine homes. Abode is home. A divine, or God, the home of God, or traditionally the home of Brahma, the realm of Brahma, the god Brahma. You know, so it comes through the four beautiful qualities of the heart, and they are The first one is the loving kindness, or metta, loving kindness, which is that which is wishing well for all beings to be happy and well, healthy and in good well-being. That wish we put out. The second one is when that love turns towards the suffering. And when the love touches the suffering element, the heart moves in compassion. So it's different than the metta. Metta is more the wishing well, but when it touches the suffering, it feels the quivering of the pain. The heart feels the quivering of the pain, and it wants to relieve the suffering. It's a movement to want to help the suffering. So it's called karuna, or compassion. And then when that love turns towards the happiness and the joy, it's called the joy or the empathetic joy, mudita in Sanskrit or Pali, mudita, where we feel happy that other people are happy. We feel joy that there is joy. So the heart is up. The heart is uplifted when we meet joy. Just as when the heart meets the suffering, there's a quivering and there's a wanting to relieve that. When the heart meets the joy, it wants to join and celebrate the joy. It feels more joy. So it's called like a empathic joy or sympathetic joy. It's a meeting of that. When the love touches another who is in joy, we feel the joy. When the love touches one who is suffering, we feel the suffering. When the love touches just everything, we wish for everything to be well and to be happy and to be safe and strong. We're well-wishing. This is the movement of the heart when it's free. Free of the me, all about me, what I want, what I need, because we are meeting the other, we're in contact with. So the heart can be touched, the heart can be met, and then the heart feels the other and has the response. We respond to the other. That's where we're connected. We're so connected that we feel. We feel everything. We all feel everything. But we don't often admit it. We don't often talk about it. You know? But we're so connected. We're so sensitive. We're so sensitive and susceptible to any kind of impact. You know, so fragile. So in that connection and in that feeling, the heart, when it's uncluttered from the greed, the hatred, and delusion, we start to respond in that connection with well-wishing and with compassion and with joy and celebration, gratitude. And then the fourth divine abode, the fourth home, beautiful home of the heart, is called... In the Sanskrit, it's upeka, which is translated as the word equanimity, which I know I've checked is many people don't know this word, equanimity. But it means a balance, it's unreactive, the unreactive heart. So a mind, the heart that isn't needing things to be a certain way. It's not caught up in this pushing and pulling. It is balanced with what's occurring. It's balanced with what's happening. It's a mind that says, things are the way they are. That's equanimity. Things are the way they are. No matter how much I would like things to be different, things are the way they are. So it's a radical acceptance of the way things are. That's the equanimity. And that fourth quality underlies the loving kindness, the compassion, and the joy, or we couldn't respond because we'd be thrown out of balance. When the heart touches the suffering, if that balanced mind isn't there, we'll just be, no, this shouldn't be happening. Why is this happening? You know, and that's not the balance. That's not the ground. So the fourth abode, the fourth home, provides that ground so that we can meet the suffering without getting thrown off, and the heart can stay open and meet it and respond. Same with the joy. I mean, even meeting the joy, we can go, yeah, you know, and just get all, yes, I love joy, you know, but we're not on the ground. We're just kind of getting excited. That's not this beautiful quality of the heart. It's about me. Oh, I love to be excited. Yeah. So again, the ground of joy, the ground of loving kindness, the ground of compassion, the ground of equanimity. So this is the picture. This is the model for the awake mind, the awake heart, the awakened heart, or Buddha mind, Buddha heart, that's given in the Buddha's teachings. I think it's a good model. And then in other traditions, they add more qualities of the awakened heart. So, but these four are the ones that we work on, and it's good in our own practice to pay attention when these qualities are alive in you. When you feel the compassion, you feel you care about others without falling into, oh, it shouldn't be happening like this. But you just, this is the way it is and I want to help. Or when you're just simply happy and you're wanting every being to be happy. You're just wishing well. There's a story about one of our teachers, Munindraji, an Indian teacher, the teacher of Joseph Goldstein. If you know Joseph Goldstein, one of the founders of the Vipassana in the West. And Munindraji from India, one of his first trips to America, came to on the East Coast, and he, being the first trip in America, they took him to an aquarium where the fish were in the aquarium. Because I don't think he had seen something like that before, keeping all the fish in the different tanks. And so he was going into the aquarium and just tapping on all the glass, oh, may you be happy, may you be happy, may you be happy. He was just blessing all the fish, just going through, just, oh, be happy, be happy, be happy. Just through the whole aquarium. You know, just this well-wishing, just pouring out of his heart, you know. So it's a good, we can practice this, you know, when we're in the grocery store or when, you know, people are coming, oh, wishing you happiness, may you be happy. You know, the heart opens. We practice this. This is the loving kindness practice. But all kinds of, there's so many practices that are available to us to develop these qualities of the heart. But rather than just the developing, what I'm interested in is noticing the natural expression of these qualities that are already happening. It's like we think that this is something in the future, you know, maybe when my practice gets stronger, or you know, when I get more enlightened, maybe then I'll have these experiences. But actually, you're having them now. But you're maybe not recognizing them, or you may not have a context to understand them. So it's good, I think, to have some way to hold this understanding of the awakened mind, or the enlightened mind, the enlightened heart, and see how it's already here. It's already happening. Just an expression of kindness towards somebody. When you care about somebody or you're looking after somebody. And it's pure. It's not complicated. You're just the movement where you want to offer food or give somebody some warm clothes or somebody had an accident and you go and you help them with their accident. You know, I mean, so many ways the heart is just responding. Just responding. It's not complicated. We don't have to think about it. Right? This is a natural expression of the awakened mind. It's not about me. When I get out of the way and I'm there for the other, we can notice how this is actually happening in our lives now. And I think it's a very good practice to see that so we don't, again, think this is something in the future. This is something that happens along the way. But we are already awake. We are already awake. And that breaks through, that comes through many, many times in the day. And it's kind of that, it's a kind of a crack, but it's not even a crack so much as it's just naturally who we are. It's just naturally who we are. So we start to recognize that more, that, oh yeah, actually my heart is actually quite open. I have a lot of love in my heart. Recognize that, acknowledge that. I think it's very beneficial. And it doesn't have to necessarily build up a more sense of me. I have a very loving heart. You know, I think we're afraid of that. You know, we don't want anyone to think that I'm conceited in that way. You know, it's just, no, it's, I can see that, I can feel that. It's a good thing to recognize. I think maybe I'll end with this this story. Maybe this is a good place for this story. And I sometimes think that, you know, those of you who are, you know, reading or listening to Dharma talks, you've heard some of these stories, but it's always good to hear the stories again. And this story is from Jack Kornfield in one of his books called The Wise Heart. And he tells this story. This is an experience that happened to him when he was in Thailand. And a story that he heard about and from the monks in Thailand. And so he tells the story like this. He says, in a large temple in Thailand, there was an enormous clay Buddha. And it had survived for over 500 years. At one point, however, the monks who tended the temple noticed that the statue had begun to crack and would soon be in need of repair and repainting. After a stretch of particularly hot and dry weather, one of the cracks became so wide that a curious monk took his flashlight and peered inside. What shone back at him was a flash of brilliant gold. Inside this plain old statue, the temple residents discovered one of the largest and the most luminous gold images of the Buddha ever created in Southeast Asia. It was solid gold inside this clay. The monks believed that this shining work of art had been covered in plaster and clay to protect it during the times of war and conflict and unrest. So they took this solid gold statue and covered it. And so over the generations, people didn't know anymore that what was behind it until it cracked. And here it was solid gold. And now this golden Buddha draws masses of devoted pilgrims from all over Thailand. And so it's very much like that with us. You know, we think that we are kind of this plastered, you know, clay, you know, plaster. There's no gold here. But yet when these cracks appear, you know, when this opening comes, what comes forth is the shimmering gold of our own Buddha nature, our own heart, our own being. That in the same way, our essence of our being, who we really are, is solid gold. Solid gold, Buddha nature. It's just covered over. Covered over. But not as much as we think. I think we just have to pay attention to those times when the gold is already shining. It's already shining. And sometimes other people can see it, yeah? Other people can see it, but you can't see it. It's like, can't you see? Can't you see? Oh, how beautiful you are. And sometimes we can't see it, right? But it's there. Right? So this is what we're working with. Wow. What is really here? Who am I? Who am I when I let go of the stories of me? And all the way that my sense of me gets constructed and defined, and I stop believing it. I stop believing it in the same way. Maybe something else can shine through, something else comes through that is completely unexpected and unimaginable, but very beautiful. So let's sit just quietly for a moment or two.